Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we also got to point out that if you're looking to join prayer circles, have a prayer circle, what have you, because praying for the movement and getting people, helping people get engaged and helping people have successes and so forth. As I said, if there's some people that have basically contacted me, and again, I'm not asking you to pray for me. I'm asking you to pray for America, pray for the Constitution, and all of those who are engaged in trying to preserve our liberty and restore our constitutional republic. So the last common thing I always say is do not forget that that debt that we're looking at, that clock, that debt clock, that is fraud. We do not owe that debt. We're not accountable to that. And so bottom line, what we need to do is we need to start holding people accountable because they're spending money they have no authority to do. Now, speaking of which, we got Tammy with us. And Tammy, we just covered Article 1, Section 9, and we actually covered that line, or I should say that subsection 7, little clause 7 or the paragraph 7, whatever, as you look at it in the Constitution. No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. So, in other words, if they're going to create a law, then that is the only way that they can actually draw on money. And in addition, they actually have to make appropriations for how they're going to pay for that. So 9 times out of 10, when they try to,
it has to be constitutional.
Well, yeah, so there's that. It needs to be one in pursuant to the Constitution. And so here's a good case in point. Let's say that they're going to, add an impost on certain types of goods coming in, food or something like that. And so for them to be able to, add that tax, they need to hire some people to be able to execute that. So they need to basically, by passing that bill, there has to be the cost effect on what they have to spend and how much they need to make. So in other words, they're creating this tax, and they're planning on making more money than what they would if they didn't have the tax, but they still have to spend money to make money. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they need to be very clear and very accurate as to how government is to function. They do not have the ability to just, spend willy-nilly. And I really feel bad for people with the name Willie or Nilly. But anyway, because, that's an adage that's out there that if your name's Willie, then whenever, people say that, you go, doggone, I wish that wasn't, I wish that didn't exist or whatever. Anyway, kind of like Karen, right?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, a while ago, I felt sorry because that term Karen has really done a lot of good Karens out there, injustice. Because now they have a name that, is associated to a bad thing. And anyway, so that's
well.
What
there's
do.
Also Brandon.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. because actually, that was the race car driver's name that they were talking to, right? I mean, the gal will say, "Hey, they're shouting your name. Let's go, Brandon." Yeah. Anyway, all right. So now we're going to dive into the title of nobility. And this clause was, right here, this is in the Constitution. But what they do, and we're going to jump ahead and we're going to read the 13th Amendment after we do this, because, and remember that the 13th Amendment was actually written and passed by framers. I mean, this was during Madison's presidency. And the reality is here is something in the Constitution, and then they created an amendment to actually make sure that there was this greater pushback against a legal movement in the United States. So go ahead, let's read subsection 8, or the final subsection of section 10.
Okay, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, except of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Okay, what I just did was I actually highlighted the shall be granted by the United States. Now, it says no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. I believe that we are doing that to former presidents and so forth. Once you are no longer in office, that's it. You're Joe Citizen. You're Billy Bob Thornton, whatever. So what has happened is they've actually created both a title and they've provided emoluments. So if you go down here, emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. But we're not even supposed to be playing in that as well, because no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States either. And the fact is that we're creating this, you know, I'll call it this title of nobility for former public servants. Where do they get off doing that? The Constitution was really clear to basically not, they didn't want themselves to be elevated. Now, most people, if you've ever read, I think it's Ron Chernow's biography on George Washington, when he retired, he went back to Mount Vernon and he was, you know, just doing his, you know, going back to life. He didn't have this position or emoluments. He made no money. Now that his compensation, or now that his terms were done, his compensation had been finished. So when people...
We're not supposed to continue to call them president?
Nope.
After they're no longer?
Nope. I mean, he still had his title as General Washington, but he wasn't president anymore. And so, I mean, it's one thing to, you know, offer people respect, but another thing to say that's your title. When, you know, you walk in the room, that's how you're to be announced. And so when George Washington did retire, he became such average Joe Citizen that there were many people that would, you know, stop by Mount Vernon just to visit, people he'd never even met. And many of them, I mean, you know, they would come and they would go that same day. But there were a few that came by, and because of weather or circumstances, he put them up because, you know, he was a gracious host. And so, you know, you think about, wow, what an imposition to put on somebody, especially somebody like, you know, that magnitude, just to swing by and say, hey, hi. Oh, shoot. Can you put me up? I don't want, you know, we got tornadoes. You know, I don't know how often they had tornadoes. There was just really bad wind back in those days because they didn't, you know, didn't have cameras to capture that type of stuff or radar or what have you. So I don't know if they ever, you know, when did they create the title tornado? Could have been years after. I don't know. But that is an area where they do get that stuff. They get hard weather. And so it was noted in Ron Chernow's biography that there were times when Washington was a very gracious host and extended to complete strangers who came by to give them their best wishes or what have you. And he ended up having to put them in a guest, you know, quarter, guest room or what have you. And apparently, see, Mount Vernon was a huge estate. And so there was all of these different quarters and so forth because he did business. He was an entrepreneurial endeavor. In other words, Mount Vernon manufactured nails. They did all sorts of things on that estate where, you know, they were kind of self-sustaining. They had their own, probably, I don't know if they had a lumber mill, but as I understand it, they did most all of the stuff that they needed to do so that they didn't have to buy goods from the general store.
Mm. Yeah.
So that was very common back in those days. If you had enough, and that's exactly what the larger plantations did. They would actually produce everything that they needed so that they wouldn't have to spend that money. And some of the stuff that they made, they would actually sell. And as a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson came up with a plow. He invented a plow that would, improve the performance of the current plows. And so he designed it. They started making them and selling them. So anyway, they were very industrious people. Okay, so let's jump into, if you go down in the navigation pane, or actually what I'll do is I'll just go down and read it. This is the 13th Amendment. You look at Article 1, Section 9, that very last clause. This is what they felt, they were moved to add this amendment, and it was ratified in 1812. If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from an emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them. So, in other words, he couldn't be in one or both, an office of trust and profit. So the point is that they now toned this into no U.S. citizen can receive a title of nobility, honor, and the United States can't give them. So nobody is to have them. And if you have one, then you can no longer be a citizen unless Congress allows it.
Wow.
Right. So what they had right there in Article 1, Section 9, in a restriction on the federal government, is that they couldn't do this, but they also expanded, as you can see, when we look at Article 1, Section 9, what you can see there is that they actually kind of expanded this to, be very, very specific about your citizenship. So they also had, no person shall be in office of trust or any king. So in other words, there wasn't much difference between the 13th Amendment other than the fact that if any person received it, claimed it, or what have you, any citizen, you would lose your citizenship. So why was this happening? Because the British legal system... And to be clear, the British legal system at that point in time was common law, and the British Accredited Registry was basically an institution that was done by the Crown that basically granted lawyers, because when lawyers went through this process, because under common law, anybody could represent themselves and anybody could petition the court. You didn't have to be a lawyer. As a matter of fact, common law, right. the principles of common law was to allow the household, the head of the household, to be able to defend their household over legal matters, whether it be, the surviving widow or whether it be the man or what have you. It didn't matter, the head of the household. And so when the British Accredited Registry started, and if you do the research on this, you'll find that they started acquiring these names, Esquire and so forth. And that's why you'll see that when people usually receive their Juris Doctorate, their JD, then voila, they have this thing called an Esquire title. Well, they did not want those people that were receiving the bar accreditation, even though there was no national bar, or I should say Bar of America, the American Bar Association, did not exist until 1878, after the Civil War. In other words, they created the American Bar Association, but the Bar Association is a direct derivative, and it was established by the British Accredited Registry. Now, they do everything they can today to say they're not a part of that. But that's not what happened, because we're going to get into the content. We'll get into the Organic Act, and we're going to get into the treaty made with Britain. And this is, it's a lot of material, especially that Britain, the British treaty. I think it's like 20-some pages. And so what I got to do is I need to go through it so I can highlight it so that we can focus on very specific things to expose the people with. So with that, let's go ahead and dive into Article 1, Section 10. Now, folks, Article 1, Section 9 were restrictions placed on the federal government. In other words, these things the federal government cannot do. So they couldn't grant these titles of nobility, and then they expanded on it that no person should be able to have a title of nobility in America. And so at all, whatever. And then they had to expand on that because they saw the Bar Association creeping into America, and more lawyers were becoming esquires. And they said, you do that, or you go down that path, and you basically create this affinity. I mean, in America, a foreign corporation couldn't operate. In other words, no foreign corporation could come into America and establish themselves, and then you'd be an employee, because just to be clear here, when you look at Article 1, Section 10, this is a restriction on the federal government that they can't do this, but the 13th Amendment kept anybody from a foreign entity coming in and creating an entrepreneurial or a business or a corporation and employing people. It kept them from receiving emoluments, because emoluments is the same thing as wages and pay. Mm. It's a financial benefit. So...
So what you're saying is the Chinese can't come and buy property and have business here?
It would be a violation of the 13th Amendment. So when I go back to the 13th Amendment and I read that amendment right here. Okay, so if any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, or receive or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be. So in other words, with this 13th Amendment, you cannot be an employee that is operating in the United States. You can go abroad and do that, but you can't come back to America and be a citizen. And you can't, do that in America, because bottom line, there was no way any foreign entity could own any resource. They couldn't own a company. And it's one thing to be a services oriented company, because, you know, it's not like you own any land. You're just doing services for the crown. In other words, one of the things that they were doing, they were spying. The crown was spying, and the British loyalists were providing information. They were receiving emoluments or presents or, you know, what have you. In other words, they were receiving benefits from the crown. They wanted to make sure that you couldn't do that. Not even just being an esquire, that you cannot benefit at all from a foreign entity. So,
well, that's being violated all over the place.
It sure is, isn't it? Because America, because the progressives had put America up for sale. And basically, we have lost our principles, because America's themselves, I mean, We started going down this path in our own paradigm when we actually started buying made in China, made in Indonesia, made in England, and so forth. And it was one thing to allow imports to come in, but every import was supposed to have an impost to protect American goods and American services and so forth. And what they ended up doing, and this was the insidious side of income tax, they shifted their focus of taxing America so that they could start growing the world economy. Do you see what see what happened in the early 1900s? In 1913 was when I think the 16th Amendment was passed, and or around that time. When you look at the 16th Amendment, they shifted from having a general taxation on the state on apportionment. The majority of the money that the federal government was making was literally from goods coming into America. There were imposts placed on those goods. In other words, they were protections of the American product and the American goods. And so
that makes sense.
When they created this income tax, how much, you know, so we do not tax any foreign goods unless there's, you know, some tariff or something like that. I mean, the imposts have really gone by the wayside because their focus is taking from America and opening our doors, because we get goods coming in from Europe that have the value added tax. And that's how Europe is basically making, you know, their money, because America is not supposed to be taxing anything that goes out. How is it that a car in America, made in America, that is being produced, and it's that the corporation is being taxed on their profits, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is that not an impost placed on those, or I should say an export tax placed on that stuff that's going out of America? But it's even more than that. It's a tax placed on everything that that corporation is doing and producing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, a corporation is producing and only one third of the stuff goes overseas. So that one third of the stuff cannot be taxed. But they're taxing the corporation 100% on its profits. Not 100% tax, but all of its profits are subject to a tax.
Right.
Right. So both one third of its profits, as well as the two thirds, the money that's made from within the United States, it's all being taxed.
Mm-hmm.
The design.
So none of that should be taxed, only imposts coming from other countries?
So only imports, yes. So they place imposts, which is a tax on imports. Exposts are taxes on exports. In other words, it's a tax on stuff going out. The Constitution forbade, right there in Article 1, that no tax would be levied on any exports.
Wow.
But they are taxing everything because they're taxing import or income, I mean. So
yeah,
this is how wrong and how insidious this income tax is. And the reason they did this is because they reached this critical mass where they were seeing the debt going up and up and up. And this was during the Wilson administration. And Wilson's assertion was, or when he was coming into office, he goes, America can be the greatest country in the world. The only way that we can do this, though, is by spending ourselves into prosperity. In other words, we got to spend a lot of money so that we can make a lot of money, so that we can go down this path of, you know, succeeding and, you know, lifting America to a new standard. In other words, we're going to buy our way into wealth and richness. And you can't do that. You can't create a wealthy, rich nation by spending money. The only way you get there is through productivity and being able to actually, we're going to go into a break here. So the only way you can actually get there is by saving, because saving is wealth. When you've amassed savings, you actually have buying power. You have the ability to do lots of things. But when you're in debt, spending, you actually have made yourself more vulnerable. Anyway, America bought off on Wilson's plan, and we got screwed over. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so hopefully all that makes sense as far as how we've really been kind of taken to by our government on this sneaky tax, and how they've, in so many ways, that income tax is violating the spirit of the Constitution. This is how we, the people, have been subsidizing communism throughout the world, because China is able to ship everything in here with hardly any retribution, and technically everything should have imposts. So anyway, let's go dive into 10, because we're going to find that there are similar restrictions placed upon the states. In other words, they said, you know, these things are not just good to have the federal government restricted, but these are good to, you know, remove the ability for government to do these things in America. So go ahead.
No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility.
Okay, so that's a mouthful, but there's lots of little things that they can't do. So that no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation. So in other words, when the Paris agreements were actually, you know, the Paris Treaty of climate change a few years back, probably a decade, a little over a decade, when the Paris Accord was done, all of these states that signed up with that violated that part of the Constitution. Whether they like it or not, they don't have the ability to adjoin to any international agreement, period. They have no power to they have no power whatsoever to grant letters of marque and or reprisal. And I think that's a problem, because I believe, so when we, let's just look at the war on terror and how the federal government has basically declared war. And so if you're bringing, you know, 'cause first off, we never enumerated their ability to regulate and control drugs. They just assumed that power. And then they said, okay, these drugs are okay. These drugs are not okay. And then they basically said, now we're going to go after and enforce and, you know, and keeping these drugs from people. And so, okay, you know, everybody's going, well, that's good. That's good. Well, it's good if the states do it. And if you empower your states to do that. But the only way the federal government can do it is if we amend the Constitution for them to do that, period. So when they actually find a boat off the shore, and there's lots of heroin or what have you, and they confiscate that boat, that's the same thing as granting a letter of marque.
Yeah.
And so basically they're confiscating property from somebody because they've declared war on drugs. And if you come here, then they're just going to, they can't do it. The states can't do it, but the states should be able to do it because the states should actually be able to say, we're going to, you know, we want to be a zero tolerance state. You bring, you know, any foreign entity that brings any property into the United States that, you know, like a boat, an airplane, and it is that vessel is a part of the importation of these illegal substances, then we will confiscate that. So in other words, oh, you boat owners and you airplane owners, you better do your due diligence to make sure nothing is coming here that is, you know, illegal by this state, or we will confiscate it. So technically, I think that the state should be able to do this because they should have the power to be able to protect themselves, and that would be one of the ways to do that.
Right.
Now, as we kind of look at, you know, this whole, you know, assumptions of power, well, the other part is that some people think, well, you know, states can go out there and coin money. In other words, they can coin their own bills or what have you, coin, you know, silver. And I think in Wyoming is trying to coin or mint their own silver, gold coins.
Mm-hmm.
What does it say there? No state shall. And then there's this list. If you put one, enter to a treaty, alliance or confederation. Two, grant letters of marque or reprisal. Three, coin money. Is Wyoming doing this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that is a violation of the Constitution.
Yeah.
Huh. Emit bills of credit. Make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. And we are already seeing states do this. And then pass any bills of attainder, ex post facto laws, or laws impairing the obligation of contract. So if you put a number in front of all of these, you'd probably come up with like six or seven different little things that they list that no state shall do these things. Okay, and then the second one, no state shall, go ahead.
No state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws, and the net produce of all duties and imposts laid by any state or imports or exports shall be for the use of the Treasury of the United States, and all such laws shall be subject to the revision and control of the Congress.
Okay, so the only entity that can put imposts on stuff coming in into the state. Now, if you're making something in Michigan and you're going to sell it in California, California cannot put any duty impost at all on those goods. No state can do that. In other words, no state can create these fees and fines. The other thing is that they can't lay any type of tonnage or anything. And actually, we'll find this in the next one. But the point is that they allow them to have these fees that they can assign. And I believe they get into this. But the whole point is that they can only use the fees and fines for, say, New York is bringing a bunch of stuff in. And let's say only 1/10 of the goods landing in the port of New York is actually for the state of New York. So 90% of the wear and tear that is occurring on that port, on the pier, you know, on the cranes, mm-hmm. on all of the things that are happening, then they should be able to quantify, you know, who pays how much. Because if you kind of put out a depreciation or a maintenance and replacement for all of this type of equipment and so forth, how much it would cost to do that, to maintain the port, to basically say, okay, we have to
basically put out a fee for everything that's going out, regardless of what state it goes to. Every state will pay the same fee, they'll pay the same fee on their share. In other words, if one state is having 2% of the goods going through that New York port, then out of the total cost that they should be carrying, because New York will only pay 10%, and then they will pay 2%, and every other state will pay according to their apportionment or according to how much they're pulling through that port to their state. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's unconscionable that a port could actually be damaged or actually go into servicing the nation and not be able to claim any wear and tear or those costs that it is suffering and enduring. And it's not just that. So the state actually can create these imposts for, one, protecting the port, as well as the road system, as well as any other infrastructure that might be used. And so this is where transshipment points occur, where it's easier to bring things in via port and then ship it out via rail, because the maintenance on a rail is a lot less than the maintenance on roads for trucks and so forth. And so, but it doesn't pay to use the rail if you're only going to one state across. But if you're going all the way across the United States, putting that baby on the rail, or going from New York to Wyoming, putting it on a rail would be the lowest cost to the consumer. In other words, this is where shipping and handling and getting that good from China to Wyoming would be the cheapest. So that the products that are hitting Wyoming can be cheaper, you know, like all the stuff you buy in Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's really the point here, is that no state can actually start creating leverages to where they profit off of another state's consumption. That's the whole point. So going back to the regulation of commerce, the federal government's job in regulating commerce among the states is to make sure that the states play fairly. If you want to understand what that commerce clause means, it really is spelt out here that they can't be using, because they're a transshipment point. You know, if anything that's coming across land via railroad or what have you, up through Texas or down from Canada into any of the states, if they're coming that way, those states, because they're ports of entry as well, Washington, Minnesota and all the way across, right? And Michigan, all of these states where you've got productivity and it comes across the line, no state shall be able to actually add, because they're a port of entry, anything greater than what is necessary to cover the costs. That is how constrained the federal government is regarding commerce within the states. They can't get there. They're only allowed to make sure that the states have to play fairly with each other. They can't get into the states, oh, you can't make these harmful things. You can't mine this borax for soap. You can't mine gold or copper. They have no authority. There's nothing delegated to them. Have we read anything is there anything enumerated in this Constitution hitting right up to Section 10 of Article 1? We haven't seen anything where they have delegated to them the power over mineral rights.
Right.
Okay. So when we look at what the federal government can do, they're very, very limited. And the fact that they're involved in, you know, the production of oil in America, where you can do it, is fracking of shale. All of these different things that are related to energy, and they will let you have access to that land? No, they don't have control over it. I will bet you anything, the state of Wyoming is hard hit regarding the coal industry, where the federal government shut you down. where they've shut down your fracking. The fact is they don't have the authority. There's not, it's not enumerated here.
So why are we allowing them to do it?
Because a long time ago, they came along with money and said, we're going to create these regulations. And nobody saw that they would come along and actually start actually controlling the means of production. They started controlling the means of consumption, because today they're trying to tell you, you have to use this crappy, you know, sustainable energy, green energy crap. And if it's there, okay. If it's not, then tough. But that's what you have to use. So the principles of communism is initially controlling the sources of production. Go read the 10 planks. Mm-hmm. What they don't tell you on that plank is, in addition to controlling the means of production, they also want to control the means of consumption as well.
Right.
Right. So, anyway, can't tell me we haven't become communists, because that's exactly what's going on. Anyway.
Yeah, we sound pretty communist to me.
Right. So let's do the final one, because that's where they actually lay the duty of tonnage. Go ahead.
Okay, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay.
Okay, so there's a few really interesting things in this one restriction. So Congress shall without the, or no state shall without the consent of Congress lay any duty of tonnage on the goods going through. We kind of dove into that. They can't keep troops or ships of war in time of peace. In other words, they can't keep their militia services. So here's a problem. In America, we really didn't have, other than the sheriff, we didn't have enforcement agencies, right? No police. Mm-hmm. The first city that actually established a police department, if I remember correctly, at least as far as major cities, was New York. And I cover this every Christmas season, because the Christmas season was why they actually established the New York Police Department in 1828 or 1829. So what was supposed to happen was this, the states, now it wasn't written in the Constitution. The Constitution was the exemplar for every state to look at and go, you know what, if we incorporate these principles into how we govern, then we will be able to do all sorts of great things. And so what we're looking at is that when we see this right here, the keep troops or ships of war in peacetime, technically the states should be able to, because who are they supposed to use for executing the laws?
The militia.
So they should have the ability to keep troops. They should have, if all of a sudden there are problems, they shouldn't have to go to Congress to get the permission to be able to use their own resources in protecting themselves. Now, I don't know if the keep troops means other troops from other states or anything like that, but I do know this, that when we look at the keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, they should be able to, especially today with drugs and so forth, the state should have more cognizance and more control over these types of resources that are theirs.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we look at this one line right here, we don't see the states actually violating this. Actually, the federal government violates this because they're the ones that are keeping troops and ships of war in times of peace.
Mm-hmm.
The next one, enter into any agreement or compact with another state. That's problematic. I talk about this. States today, now that this consumption of water, and now that we're, you know, we've actually grown in population to a point where we've created public utilities and we actually have to provide water. Look at people in Phoenix, Arizona. How are they going to survive there? Well, what should we do? Just, you know, hey, suck it up. Either you eat dust and, you know, and live without water, or, you know, you can't do anything. Well, technically, they can get Congress's approval, but I believe the states should be able to today over domestic matters. And I think that this could either be changed to allow them to coordinate with each other without having to go through Congress. It's just wrong that these sovereign states can't have the ability to create, in, you know, without having to go through Congress, because this allows Congress to start playing manipulative games. Does that make sense? So yep. I think that, you know, some of these clauses on restrictions of the states, we need to re-examine these and actually say, you know what? I think that that's bad. I think that the state of Washington should be able, because, you know, Washington state has a lot of water. A lot of water. Who needs water? People down in the Southwest. And as a matter of fact, if anybody is familiar with the California Aqueduct, the California Aqueduct takes water from the upper Bay Area, from the Sacramento, whatever you want to call that watershed of the Sacramento River or that area, and it ships that water from there all the way down to Los Angeles. Now, that was a big endeavor, but they were able to do that, and now Los Angeles needs more water. And we're now looking at Phoenix and all these other cities, Las Vegas, they all need more water. Well, you know what? It just constantly pours and pours and pours, where Washington could easily provide a lot of water that would be necessary for these areas to actually become more sustainable. Right. Having more aqueducts and piping or what have you to be able to provide, you know, water that's going down into the interior, or in other words, on the east side of the coastal mountain plain, such as Nevada and Arizona and maybe Utah. Because some of those places are, you know, they just don't have that much water. It's just that dry and arid. And so why not? Why can't the states actually go, okay, let's do this, where the states can create a benefit to where it's not like they're creating a profit, but they can actually benefit. Anyway, so my point is,
why would the state do it unless they were profiting, though?
Well, so technically, they do. So everybody benefits when everybody becomes more productive.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
In other words, when you start succeeding, other people start succeeding. But see, what happens is we create this negativity and we start. What happens is I get punished, and so that punishes everybody else. And so we start, you know, looking with negativity and regulations. And next thing you know, well, hey, you're regulating me. Why don't you regulate that? Well, let's look at it in the 180, or let's look at it in the opposite perspective. Let's stop regulating that is not necessary. And let's actually allow people to be productive. And how can we help people become more productive? I think that we need to actually start looking at, you know, how can states increase the, you know, the speed limit so that you can drive and spend less time going from point A to point B. So that how can we do that? Do we need to start using ultralights and creating those types of systems where you can literally drive as a crow flies, or, you know, or go from your point to work without having to build these roads?
Yeah.
Right. Because now you've become far more independent, where you can actually, instead of parking, you know, driving through a road system, you can literally go from your driveway or your parking lot to your employer's parking lot and to the shopping parking lots. So we wouldn't need all the roads as much. We would still need roads because we still have to move commerce, right? You know, the water delivery guy has to, you know, make all of his stops. So we still have to have some roads, but the roads would really be more for commercial use. Anyway, my point is that when we start looking at how we govern, it is always with a negative perspective instead of an enlightened perspective to say, how can we become more productive? Anyway.
Yeah, and how can we allow them to be more productive instead of the opposite?
Right. Okay, so the last part of this is right here dealing with what's going on in the invasion on our southern border. Or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. Why are states not using that clause to actually demand that this invasion, so that they actually start creating containment areas and say, these people have to be deported. They don't belong here. This is a cultural invasion, and this is imminent danger.
Yeah.
Right. So that should be applied not only to the border states, that should be applied to all of these states. And as a matter of fact, the problem is the federal government has become the importation of invaders. So, I mean, it's a real mess. Bottom line, when we look at some of these things, the states either need to start exercising them, or they need to at least, you know, you have some of these things modified to allow the states to become far more productive. So now we're going to get into Article 2. Article 1 was all dealing with Congress. And when we look at the body of Article 1, Article 1 takes us to, let me see here. Actually, I don't want to do that. I want to look at how many pages is Article 1. Article 1 is 6 pages of 12. In other words, it's half the Constitution. So when you look at who has the most responsibility, then you can look at who has the most power. When we look at our government, because I say this all the time, and I talk about a Republican form of government, when we look at the roles and responsibilities granted to the legislative body, our representatives, then you can understand why we are a Republican form of government, because they have the bulk of the responsibilities. Mm-hmm. When you look at the president, it's very simple. He just executes the laws. And then the courts, they just examine whether the laws have been broken or not, based on how they were defined by the framers in the ratification debates, or as necessary in the initial defining by Congress and the states. So,
yeah.
Article 2 is kind of a short one, because when we look at Article 2, it goes all the way down to from page 6 to page 8, 2 pages. I mean, so it's very small. And then when we look at the judiciary, it's small too. I think the judiciary is barely a page. Barely a page. Not even a page. Well, with that, now that we're looking at it, we're going to come back tomorrow and we're going to get into Article 2. I apologize that snuck up on us. But anyway, we're here going through the Constitution because nobody is doing this. And by reading the Constitution and understanding what each line means, then we obtain power that we can act upon. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.